Chapter 8. What the politicians get and get away with that you can't. In this chapter, I want to look at the government health care and retirement benefits politicians get, but we don't. I also want to focus on how many laws the two parties make that we have to comply with, but they don't. Should elected officials have more perks than the populace they govern? Shouldn't they abide by the same laws we're supposed to? I'll let you be the judge of that. I'll start with this. Imagine what it would be like if everybody at the company you work for could vote himself or herself an annual raise in pay. Wouldn't that be a gas? Not that the management would like it much. Anyway, your U.S. Congress is quite free to do that for themselves, and most years they do. Since 1990, annual cost of living adjustments have been calculated through a formula that's based on changes in private sector wages and salaries, and Congress has accepted a pay raise 13 times. In 2009, the last time they went for this, each of the 535 members of the House and Senate combined got increases of $4,700 apiece, which cost us taxpayers about $2.5 million. The base pay for lawmakers in the two houses is $174,000 and higher for the leaders. With their approval ratings in the dumper, they decided to forego the pay raises for both of the last 2 years. The law requires them to vote against it, otherwise the increase becomes automatic. Have you ever heard of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, FEHB? That's where Congress members and other government employees obtain health insurance for themselves and their families. The FEHB's is the biggest employer-provided health insurance program in the country, with more than 8 million members. Insurers who want to take part have to provide a full gamut of benefits. Congress members can choose from an array of plans that have limits on how much they must spend out of pocket. The most popular of these plans has an out-of-pocket maximum for families of $7,000 in 2011. Everyone elected to Congress receives a subsidy equal to about three-quarters of their health insurance premiums at the taxpayer's expense. All members of Congress, plus their family members, have guaranteed access to coverage, even if they have a pre-existing condition like cancer or diabetes, and they pay the same amount for coverage whether they're healthy or sick. There's a comprehensive package of health benefits that includes coverage for physician services, preventive care, hospital care, emergency care, mental health services, and prescription drugs. Unlike what has happened to thousands of consumers in the individual market, when members of Congress get sick, their insurance company doesn't suddenly revoke their coverage. All the plans offered to members of Congress have benefits covering prescription drug needs for the entire year, no gaps. Their coverage also includes regular checkups and screenings, and if they pay a nominal annual fee for routine checkups and acute care services, they can get free care from clinics run by the office of the attending physician on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers can also utilize taxpayer-subsidized care at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. And anyone in Congress who served a minimum amount of time in office is eligible for retiree health coverage, even if he or she retires early. For appealing any claims that get denied, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, overseer of the health insurance outfits offering the coverage, offers a clear process to do so. The OPM also prints an annual guide with all the private insurance plans to select from, and OPM negotiates with insurers to secure the lowest premiums possible and to prevent drastic rate hikes from year to year. According to the OPM, the most popular provider for all federal employees is Blue Cross Blue Shield. Pretty good deal, eh? Now, let's open the window on pension plans. There's the Civil Service Retirement System, which anyone elected to Congress before 1984 generally participates in. Or, if you enter the arena after that, there's the Federal Employees Retirement System, FERS. Members do put in a percentage of their salary toward future benefits, with pensions being figured under a formula that takes into account how long they served, average of their three highest annual salaries, and an accrual rate. But according to the National Taxpayers Union, NTU, congressional pensions are typically 2 to 3 times more generous than those offered to similarly salaried workers in the private sector, and are even more generous than pensions for most federal workers. Their benefit is also protected with cost-of-living adjustments, which only 1 out of 10 private plans offer. They can also take part in a thrift savings plan, a defined contribution arrangement that works like a 401k retirement system. According to the AARP, on grounds that working in Congress means uncertain job security, elected members and their staffs receive a larger retirement benefit from FERS for each year of service than other federal employees. They also become eligible for a retirement annuity at a younger age with fewer years of service. But congressional incumbents have something like a 95% reelection rate, mainly because, in the House, their parties get to create their own safe districts, which the two gangs do together, in collusion, to make sure they are all safe. Not too much job insecurity there. I'd say few things in life could be more predictable than having the same old gang member back in bowl. In November 2004, 401 of the 435 sitting members of the House of Representatives decided to seek re-election. Of those 401, all but 5 kept their seats. In other words, incumbents seeking re-election to the House had a better than 99% success rate. In the Senate, only one incumbent seeking re-election was defeated. 25 of 26, 96%, were re-elected. Now, the 2010 midterm election was a different kettle of fish. There was a big turnover, with 120 members of the House moving on to something new in life. Well, sort of. The majority of the departed simply passed through a revolving door that shuffles former federal employees into jobs as lobbyists, consultants, and strategists, just as the door pulls former hired guns into government careers. While officials in the executive branch, Congress, and senior congressional staffers spin in and out to the private and public sectors, so too does privilege, power, access, and, of course, money. A private study found that almost 33% went to work for a lobbying firm, while another 20.3% became lobbying clients. Okay, so what about pensions for our chief executives? Since the 1950s, they've been covered under the Former President's Act. NTU's Vice President for Policy and Communications, Pete Sepp, says, "What started as a modest system to help Harry Truman answer his mail has become a millionaire's club for ex-presidents, and taxpayers are the ones covering the dues." NTU calculated that Bill Clinton's lifetime pension payout is $6.97 million, while George W. Bush's will add up to a likely $5.56 million if he lives to be 83.5. Dick Cheney comes out pretty well, too, even though he was only VP, at around $3.24 million. And this is not to mention the staff, travel, mail, and office expense reimbursements, which, for Clinton, in fiscal year 2006, equaled $1.16 million, plus ongoing Secret Service protection for the ex-president and his wife. Speaking of office expenses, the last analysis made by the NTU showed that members of the House in 2005 spent $525 million on their offices, which was 20% higher than in 2001. I'm sure a lot of that was to make the offices more secure after 9/11. They got what are called members' representational allowances to do this, which are based on things like the population of their district and the current rents there. A lot of them go beyond their allowance and are allowed to make adjustments. One of the top perks of House members and senators is the ability to send postage-free informational letters or announcements to their constituents on a regular basis. In 2005, the House spent $22.3 million on what's called franked mail postage, 85% of this being mass mailings of 500 or more identical pieces. I wouldn't call that franked. I'd frankly call it junk. The office budget allotments also provide enough money to hire sizable staffs, both in the nation's capital and back home, wherever they hail from. Of course, a lot of that staff work and all those free mailings mainly goes toward making sure the member of Congress gets reelected, helping to ensure the boss is well-liked by the constituents. Congress members also get travel allowances for trips between D.C. and their home districts, as well as for inside their states. And if you've got a yen for foreign journeys, run for office. As for CODELs, which stand for Congressional Delegation Foreign Trips, travel abroad has tripled over the past 10 years, but between $30 and $40 million in travel costs have gone unreported. Members are technically responsible for returning excess per diem, but this rule is not enforced. Furthermore, members are supposed to complete a detailed disclosure of expended funds when they return from a CODEL. But the Congressional Research Service has said these disclosures are of limited utility, since they are often filed late and filled with inaccuracies. In response, the Stay Put Act was filed in 2010 by Representative Tim Johnson, a Republican from Illinois, but you can bet your latest travel voucher that this never got out of committee. During his first 2 years in office, Barack Obama became the most widely traveled president in our history. He made 15 trips to 34 countries, traveling abroad for a total of 55 days. George W. Bush is in second place with 11 trips, 28 visits, and 47 days. Overall, Bill Clinton is still in the lead for a two-termer, with 55 total trips and 233 days out of the country. We'll see if Obama ends up topping that one. And while we're on the subject of travel, in November 2010, Representative Ron Paul introduced H.R. 6416, a bill to ensure that certain federal employees cannot hide behind immunity. Specifically, the legislation was aimed at protecting Americans from physical and emotional abuse by Federal Transportation Security Administration, TSA personnel, who conduct the security screenings at our airports. That's what my lawsuit was about, too, but more on that later. Here's an excerpt from what Paul said in introducing his American Traveler Dignity Act. It removes the immunity from anybody in the federal government that does anything that you or I can't do. If you can't grope another person, and if you can't x-ray people and endanger them with possible x-rays, you can't take nude photographs of individuals, why do we allow the government to do it? We would go to jail. He'd be immediately arrested if an individual citizen went out and did these things. And yet we just sit there calmly and say, oh, they're making us safe. Let's make sure that every member of Congress goes through this, Paul said. Get the x-ray and make them look at the pictures. And then go through one of those groping pat-downs. And then I think there will be a difference. Have everybody in the executive branch, anybody who is a cabinet member, make them go through it and look at it. Maybe they would pay more attention. It's a no-brainer. Our elected officials manage to leave D.C., if they ever do, with more bucks in the bank than when they arrived. One way to do that is by insider trading on the stock market. You've heard about financial bigwigs getting busted for doing the same thing. Raj Rajaratnam of hedge fund fame recently got sentenced to 11 years in prison and socked with a record $92.8 million fine. The SEC, looking to bolster its image after being asleep at the wheel for Bernie Madoff, filed 57 actions against alleged inside traders in 2011. But if you happen to be a member of Congress, it's long been legal to use such confidential information for personal gain. A paper published by the Journal of Financial and Quantitative Analysis in 2004 looked at how the majority of U.S. senators were trading stocks during the boom years of the mid-90s. On average, they were beating the market by 12% a year. There was no difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of who made out better. Compare that to 5% beating the market by corporate insiders and to underperformance by typical households at 1.4%. As one analyst put it, 12% is a statistically shocking number, way beyond luck or just being smart. Nobody does that well. Not George Soros. Not Warren Buffett. In 2004, the Stock Act was introduced by a former congressman from Washington State, Brian Baird, trying to establish some rules on conflict of interest and a ban on insider trading. It went nowhere until this year, after a hard-hitting report by CBS 60 Minutes and a new book called Throw Them All Out, when suddenly Congress got antsy about the practice. Lo and behold, the Stock Act had overwhelming bipartisan support and passed both houses. Now, lawmakers and other senior officials, including the president and vice president, will be required to report their investment transactions every month or 45 days instead of yearly. We'll see if that makes a difference. In the meantime, here's some of what the 60 Minutes report revealed. Alabama Representative Spencer Baucus, a Republican who chairs the House Financial Services Committee, attended closed-door meetings in mid-September 2008 with Bush's Fed Chairman and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who were warning about a coming global financial meltdown. And literally the next day, Congressman Baucus would engage in buying stock options based on these apocalyptic briefings. He bet against the market in what they call a short option, and he sold his shares in General Electric at a profit before GE's stock price plummeted. Early in 2012, Baucus came under investigation by the Office of Congressional Ethics. Cripps, under the microscope for other possible insider trades during the financial crisis, are Senators John Kerry and Dick Durbin and Representative Jim Moran. In March 2008, then House Speaker Democrat Nancy Pelosi and her husband accepted a quite lucrative IPO, initial public stock offering, whereby they bought 5,000 shares of Visa for $44. 2 days later, the stock was trading at $64. The timing was interesting, because a piece of legislation that would have been hurtful to credit card companies was just starting to work its way through the House, and guess what? It never got to the floor. The Pelosis benefited from at least 8 IPOs. In 2009, members, including today's Republican Majority Leader John Boehner, were working overtime to kill the government-funded public option on health care that would have competed with the big insurance companies. A few days before Boehner and his buddy succeeded, his financial advisor was buying health insurance stocks, all of which went up once the public option was dead. In the past few years, the 60 Minutes report said, a whole new, totally unregulated, $100 million industry has grown up in Washington called political intelligence. It employs former congressmen and former staffers to scour the halls of the Capitol, gathering valuable non-public information, then selling it to hedge funds and traders on Wall Street who can trade on it. You scratch my back, I'll get you some more pork. There are massive amounts of money involved here, but the Republicans managed to get rid of language in the stock bill that would have made these outfits register, the same as lobbyists do. To me, this is a level of corruption that defies rational discourse. I mean, corporate insiders are required to disclose their transactions within 48 hours. Why shouldn't Congress be held to the same standard? But both Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, and his blood brother Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, were said to be busy doing all they could to weaken the final version of the Stock Act. The gangs want their equal opportunity rewards. Here's one you've probably forgotten. Back in 2003, U.S. Representative Bill Janklow, former governor of South Dakota, had been drinking and was speeding when his car struck and killed a guy on a motorcycle. At his trial, it came out that he'd been stopped for speeding on many occasions, but almost never got ticketed because of his office. Janklow got convicted of vehicular manslaughter and was sentenced to 100 days in jail, but he was released after only 30 days to do community service. Well, Janklow did end up resigning from Congress, so I guess we can count our blessings. He received 4 more speeding citations after his probation ended in 2007. But by then, the South Dakota Supreme Court had granted his petition for early reinstatement of his license to practice law. If we lie to a judge or falsify documents submitted to a court, it's considered perjury or fraud and we go to jail. Politicians and their minions do the same things and nothing happens to them. Except on rare occasions, often when it's somebody's payback time. Think Illinois former Governor Rod Blagojevich, sentenced to 14 years for trying to sell a Senate seat. I suppose lying has always been a political art, but what does it take to be over the top? Tricky Dick I Am Not a Crook Nixon got pardoned for his assorted crimes by his successor Gerald Ford, whose own malfeasance, I might add, dated back to knowingly falsifying the single bullet theory for the Warren Commission looking into JFK's assassination. In the 90s, we had the Iran-Contra caper under Reagan and Oliver North, his national security aide for covert ops. North's notebooks, released through the Freedom of Information Act in 1989, show beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was informed many times about the Nicaraguan Contra's ties to drug dealers. Even before that, the Kerry Subcommittee on Narcotics, terrorism, and international operations had concluded that senior U.S. policymakers were not immune to the idea that drug money was a perfect solution to the Contras' funding problems. Behind closed doors, the congressman holding the Iran-Contra hearings knew all about this but looked the other way and let North, among others in the Reagan administration, lie through their teeth. Meantime, Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign was in full swing. Consider the results, in terms of the American people, of the war on drugs that began under Nixon. As of 2004, more than 500,000 people were behind bars for drug offenses in our country. The Justice Department's own statistics showed that 55% of all federal prisoners and 21% of state prisoners were doing time for drugs. I find this hypocrisy staggering. Of course, Oliver North ended up running for U.S. Senator in Virginia, and a heck of a lot of people voted for the man. By the way, did you know his code name was Hammer? That was also what people called Tom the Hammer DeLay, who had to resign his leadership spot in Congress in 2006 after being indicted for conspiring to launder corporate money through the Republican National Committee for Campaign Donations, which was illegal in Texas. DeLay ended up being sentenced to 3 years in prison, but was released the same day on a $10,000 appeal bond. He told the judge, "I can't be remorseful for something I think I didn't do." DeLay said he'd already raised and spent $10 million on legal fees, but "I've got some friends who help me pay bills." You may have last seen him as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars, and I'm not making that up. Among the Democrats, consider New York Representative Charles Rangel. He started being investigated a few years ago after news reports that he had accepted 4 rent-stabilized apartments at prices hundreds of dollars per month below their market value. In the next months, he was accused of failing to declare hundreds of thousands of dollars of personal assets on his financial disclosure forms, failing to pay state and federal taxes on rental income on his villa in the Dominican Republic, and helping to preserve a tax loophole worth hundreds of millions of dollars for an oil company at the same time that he was seeking a $1 million contribution to the Rangel Center from a company executive. In November 2010, a House panel found Rangel guilty of 11 counts of ethics violations, and less than a month later, the full House censured him. What that means is that he had to stand in front of all the other members and listen to the censure resolution against him. Oh, and he also had to resign from the Ways and Means Committee. Less than a year later, a lot of those same members held a big fundraiser for Rangel at a posh D.C. restaurant. And of course, he's still sitting in Congress. Contrast this look-the-other-way treatment with what's happening to U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning, the soldier who's facing possible life in prison for revealing the truth. He's been charged with passing on hundreds of thousands of documents that expose government secrets to the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. These documents are chock-full with revelations about lying, corruption, and other crimes committed by the United States and other nations. Except, like Manning's lawyers have been asserting, a lot of what WikiLeaks published wasn't really secret or shouldn't have been classified as such. That hasn't stopped Manning from being held for months, 23 hours a day, in illegal solitary confinement at the Quantico Marine Base. According to the medical experts, after 60 days in solitary, a person's mental condition starts to deteriorate severely. In Manning's case, it's been designed to break him down enough to implicate Julian Assange, WikiLeaks founder, as his co-conspirator. But Manning never has. He may be barely able to stand, but he's still a stand-up guy. Something you may not know. Congressional staffers and other federal employees must undergo scrupulous background checks and extensive interviews before they can have access to sensitive information. You're considered a risk if you even associate with people who have a history of alcoholism or financial problems or a criminal background, let alone have such things in your own past. Security clearance denied. But if you're a member of Congress, you're not subjected to any such background check. You're granted a security clearance just because you've gotten elected. All you're asked is to promise that you won't reveal any of our country's secrets. Well, like Keith Ashdown of Taxpayers for Common Sense puts it, there are more alcoholics in Congress than anywhere in the country. Lawmakers should absolutely have to go through the same security clearance process as employees do. One example that Winslow Wheeler, author of Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security, has given us is Randy Duke Cunningham, a California congressman mentioned earlier, who eventually pled guilty to accepting $2.4 million in bribes from defense contractor MZM Incorporated. But during the 5 months Cunningham was under federal investigation, he still retained access to our country's most sensitive information. Of course, he was still getting his government pension, too, eligible for an initial annual payout of as much as $64,000, according to the National Taxpayers Union. At that time, in 2006, no member of Congress is required to forfeit a pension unless convicted of crimes related to treason and espionage. As a result, over the past 25 years, at least 20 lawmakers guilty of other serious offenses have enjoyed congressional retirement payments. What do former Congressman Dan Rostenkowski, Democrat, Illinois, James Traficant, Democrat, Ohio, and Bob Ney, Republican, Ohio, have in common with Duke Cunningham? Yep, all are convicted felons still reaping generous pensions, all told more than $250,000 a year for the rest of their lives from us, the taxpayers. In 2007, Congress did finally pass a law that stops cronies who've gotten convicted of particular crimes from raking in the pension profits, but that only applies to 11 different kinds of felonies and not crimes like evading taxes. The law doesn't apply retroactively either to the dukes of this realm. I'll close this chapter with one thought. You probably read about SOPA, S-O-P-A, the Stop Online Piracy Act, that was introduced in the House and looked for a good while like it would become law. I delve into the ramifications in a later chapter on civil liberties, but for now consider what one watchdog group learned. We wondered how many of the employees there have engaged in unauthorized copying. The answer is they pirate a lot. In total, we found more than 800 IP addresses assigned to the U.S. House of Representatives from where content has been shared on BitTorrent sites. It quickly became clear the House isn't just using it for legitimate downloads. Nope. While tens of thousands of Americans have been sued for file sharing by the Recording Industry Association of America, I guess they haven't fully cleaned house. Chapter 9, The Obama Administration. Spare change you can believe in? Part of the flaw of the two-party system is that it's induced a sense of denial about the extent of our nation's problems. In other words, both sides employ spin so effectively that American voters are reduced to mere spectators in a vast political drama that includes partisan bickering and political impasse on the floors of Congress, while the gridlock and cost of fighting two wars has sent the economy toward the brink of disaster. In 2008, Barack Obama ran on a popular theme to transcend partisan politics, which appealed to a wide block of independent voters. Unfortunately for us and Obama, it hasn't quite worked out that way. A lot of reasons have been put forward for Obama's drop in popularity, including the mess he inherited from the Bush administration and the ongoing sabotage of anything positive he tries to do by the Republicans. But has anything really changed? I honestly don't think so. What I'm going to get into in this chapter is something that deeply disturbs me. All the power Bush gave the presidency, Obama is using as well, and not for good ends. I'll lead off with this example. Where in the Constitution and Bill of Rights does it say national security trumps them both? Back in 2005, then-Senator Obama strongly condemned aspects of the Patriot Act. Among other things, he said, "If someone wants to know why their own government has decided to go on a fishing expedition through every personal record or private document, through library books they've read, in phone calls they've made, this legislation gives people no rights to appeal the need for such a search in a court of law. No judge will hear their plea. No jury will hear their case. This is just plain wrong." But in May 2011, Obama approved a congressional 4-year extension of parts of the Patriot Act that would have otherwise expired. These included letting the government seize records without the owner's knowledge, conduct secret surveillance of suspicious people who have no known ties to terrorist groups, and to obtain secret roving wiretaps on people. During the presidential campaign, Obama promised to close the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. He didn't. He announced his first year that no CIA agent would be prosecuted for torturing. And later, his administration refused to go after any of the Bush officials who'd been responsible for ordering or justifying the goings-on at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and elsewhere. The surveillance without warrants and the military tribunals denying defendants their basic rights begun under Bush have continued. At the same time, Obama's administration has fought to block dozens of public interest lawsuits challenging privacy violations and presidential abuses. The new president not only retained the controversial Bush policies, he expanded on them. In September 2011 in Yemen, a country we are not at war with, our military murdered Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen and supposed traitor terrorist. He never took up arms, but was said to have provided material support to terrorism. And then 2 weeks later, our drones also killed his 16-year-old U.S.-born son. Supposedly, the Fourth Amendment guarantees that nobody can be seized unreasonably by our government. The Fifth Amendment states that the government can't deprive someone of life without due process of law. And the Sixth Amendment gives any of our accused citizens the right to a speedy and public trial and habeas corpus. We simply blew this guy and his son away from a safe distance. Is it now the right of the executive branch to order the execution of an American citizen on the whim of the president? And Obama was a professor of constitutional law? Even though we have a federal law against murder and an executive order banning assassinations, a secret memo written over a year earlier determined that killing al-Awlaki was lawful in the event it was not feasible to take him alive. Obama and his advisors were judge, jury, and executioners of an American citizen. Couple this with the vast increase in our capacity for surveillance and remote control killing, and we've entered a very dangerous realm where constitutional rights become essentially meaningless. I'm well aware that our government has carried out murders in the past of U.S. and foreign nationals, but now it's being done in the open and with the full blessing of government, press, and public opinion. We're not just on a slippery slope. We're already well on our way downhill and picking up speed fast. It came out last December in the Washington Post that the United States, under Obama, has carried out top-secret drone attacks in at least 6 Muslim countries. Who are they killing? And why doesn't this have to be divulged? The only member of the team who objected, Dennis Blair, got fired as Director of National Intelligence. In February 2012, the head of our military's Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, Admiral William McRaven, is said to have asked for more autonomy to send elite killer squads to every corner of the globe. This includes the Navy SEALs and the Green Berets, which have gone from only 1,800 troops in 1980 to more than 25,000 today. The SEALs were created by President Kennedy, and I'm proud to say that I served as one of them, with the underwater demolition teams. But I never anticipated seeing special ops forces deployed in more than 75 countries in our ever-expanding role as policemen to the world. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, JSOC units have been involved in some of the worst atrocities. They carried out wholesale assassinations of opponents of the Iraqi occupation during the 2007 surge ordered by the Bush administration and were implicated in systematic torture of detainees. In Afghanistan, these units were responsible for the infamous 2002 wedding massacre, where they called in an AC-130 gunship to rake a wedding party and other civilian targets, leaving hundreds dead and wounded. Unlike the CIA, the JSOC is not required to secure a presidential finding authorizing lethal covert operations or submit to congressional oversight. It pains me that the SEALs are today forced to be part of illegal gangland operations. In early March 2012, Attorney General Eric Holder gave a speech at Northwestern University Law School. During that speech, he basically laid out in detail the legal theory behind being able to kill American citizens who are suspected of terrorism without any charges or trial. Due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security, Holder told the students. The Constitution does not require the president to delay action until some theoretical end stage of planning when the precise time, place, and manner of attack become clear. We are at war with a stateless enemy, prone to shifting operations from country to country. This is an indicator of our times, not a departure from our laws and our values. Along these lines, it seems to me that everything Bush implemented, Obama has backed up, if not taken farther. So in a way, the Democrats are even more deceitful than the Republicans. One of Obama's longtime colleagues and an informal advisor to his 2008 campaign came out with strong criticism about how the president has done so little to change Bush's policies on government secrecy. Jeffrey R. Stone, a law professor at the University of Chicago and board chair of the American Constitution Society, wrote in June 2011 that Obama has followed Mr. Bush in zealously applying the state secrets doctrine, which had been invoked in an unprecedented manner by the Bush administration to block judicial review of a broad range of questionable practices. Think torture, surveilling people's private communications, and restricting habeas corpus. After first saying this doctrine should be rarely invoked, since then the Obama administration has aggressively asserted the privilege in litigation involving such issues as the CIA's use of extraordinary rendition and the National Security Agency's practice of wiretapping American citizens. Senator Obama, Stone added, was a sponsor of the Free Flow of Information Act so journalists could protect confidentiality of sources. But President Obama didn't support it in what seems to be a recurring theme. The administration's attitude is a lesson in trust us. The problem is, trust us is no way to run a self-governing society. During the first year of Obama's administration, the number of new national security secrets increased by 22.6%. Back in 2009, Obama said that a democracy requires accountability, and accountability requires transparency, and that the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, encouraged both. The FOIA came into existence after Watergate in 1974 as a landmark law that's made it possible for citizens to learn more about the hidden workings of our government than ever before. It's pretty much forgotten today that President Gerald Ford actually vetoed the legislation on the advice of his chief of staff, Donald Rumsfeld, and Rummy's deputy, Dick Cheney. But Congress did the unthinkable, at least it would be unthinkable today. They voted to override the veto. But as of October 30, 2011, the Obama administration proposed making rule changes to the FOIA. If a document might be seen to interfere with an enforcement proceeding, the agency could not only deny the request for it, but can also pretend the document didn't even exist. Disguised as a minor bureaucratic adjustment, that's legalizing lying. It's a crime for a citizen to lie to the government, but fine and dandy for the government to lie to its citizens? And this is the same president who just talked about an open government partnership? It's ironic that as a senator, Obama was a champion of the Federal Funding Transparency and Accountability Act that passed in 2006. This was responsible, among other things, for the website usaspending.gov that enabled researchers like Alison Stenger to find out about all that money going to private contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I wrote about in Chapter 5. Now, Congress has proposed cutting the funding for these open government initiatives from $35 million to $8 million, which Stanger believes would shut that website down and keep still more important information from the American people. The Obama gang has also charged six whistleblowers under the pre-World War I Espionage Act. And that's more than all the previous administrations in American history put together. One of them was an advisor to the National Security Agency charged with 10 felonies for informing the media that government eavesdroppers were wasting hundreds of millions of dollars on misguided and failed projects. A federal judge thought the case against Thomas Drake was outrageous and let the fellow plead to a misdemeanor, misuse of a government computer, and walk. But this was after Drake's house was raided at gunpoint and the National Security Agency had dumped him from his job. The most recent case in January was going after ex-CIA officer John Kiriakou for telling journalists some classified scoop on our waterboarding of Al-Qaeda suspects. The real don't ask, don't tell. Short of prosecution, there are subtler methods employed to break dissenters. Peter Van Buren was a 23-year career Foreign Service officer who wrote a critical book while still employed by the State Department, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. It exposed what state did not want people to know, he says, that they had wasted enormous amounts of money in Iraq, mostly due to ignorance and a desire for short-term successes that could be trumpeted back home. Not exactly earth-shaking news, but state retaliated by suspending his security clearance, banning him from entering the building where he worked, and threatened felony charges. Not to mention examining all his travel vouchers, his internet activity, and his credit reports. Oh, and impounding his diplomatic passport. Speaking of what Van Buren revealed about Iraq, we were told that the last American troops were supposedly withdrawn just before 2012 dawned, but the Defense Department is requesting about $2.9 billion to cover the cost of post-Operation New Dawn, OND, Iraq activities. This is for a war, mind you, that we're no longer engaged in. As for that other war, the one in Afghanistan, where American troops have been burning Korans and even gunning down innocent civilians, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, a 17-year Army vet just back from his second tour there, wrote an 84-page unclassified report, of which Rolling Stone got a copy. It opened with this: senior-ranking U.S. military leaders have so distorted the truth when communicating with the U.S. Congress and American people in regards to conditions on the ground in Afghanistan that the truth has become unrecognizable. This deception has damaged America's credibility among both our allies and enemies, severely limiting our ability to reach a political solution to the war in Afghanistan. He's called for holding congressional hearings. Unnamed Pentagon officials are threatening to investigate Davis for possible security violations. During a point in history when our government has been accused of sending prisoners to secret locations where they were said to have been tortured and the CIA is conducting remote-controlled wars in far-flung places, it's not a good time to treat the people who aid in the publication of critical information as spies, David Carr wrote in an op-ed recently for the New York Times. And it's worth pointing out that the administration's emphasis on secrecy comes and goes depending on the news. Reporters were immediately and endlessly briefed on the secret operation that successfully found and killed Osama bin Laden. And the drone program in Pakistan and Afghanistan comes to light in a very organized and systematic way every time there is a successful mission. On our domestic front, Obama did get the health care reform law passed, if it survives the Supreme Court, watered down though it may be. He did pull America back from the brink of another Great Depression, flawed though the means were to the end. He did, to a limited degree, expand financial regulation and opened a national education reform initiative. And he took a major stand early in this election year by appointing a tough dude named Richard Cordray to run the new Consumer Protection Agency, while the Republicans were away on recess. Cordray, blocked earlier by a filibuster, supposedly can now move forward on regulating a wide array of debt collectors, credit bureaus, and other scurrilous scumbags of low finance. But when dialing for dollars is pretty much the only choice you've got, and that's what our two-party gang system has come down to, idealistic promises may never have a prayer of being fulfilled. That is, if they were real in the first place. The real conundrum, as psychologist Drew Weston has written, is why the president seems so compelled to take both sides of every issue, encouraging voters to project whatever they want on him, and hoping they won't realize which hand is holding the rabbit, that a large section of the country views him as a socialist, while many in his own party are concluding that he does not share their values speaks volumes. Weston pointed out that Obama presents inconsistent positions without apparently recognizing their incoherence. He announces in a speech on energy and climate change that we need to expand offshore oil drilling and coal production, two methods of obtaining fuels that contribute to the extreme weather Americans are now seeing. He supports a health care law that will use Medicaid to insure about 15 million more Americans and then endorses a budget plan that, through cuts to state budgets, will most likely decimate Medicaid and other essential programs for children, senior citizens, and people who are vulnerable by virtue of disabilities or an economy that is getting weaker by the day. He gives a major speech on immigration reform after deporting more than 700,000 immigrants in 2 years, a pace faster than nearly any other period in American history. In another example of Obama double talk, at his big populist speech in Kansas in December 2011, the president said, Too often we've seen Wall Street firms violating major anti-fraud laws because the penalties are too weak and there's no price for being a repeat offender. 5 days after that, appearing on 60 Minutes, Obama said some of the least ethical behavior on Wall Street wasn't illegal. What? There's been a veritable crime wave of, by, and for the street. Five big banks recently settled with the Obama administration for about $20 billion for their shady mortgage lending practices. A drop in the bucket, basically, when you consider their size, no criminal charges filed, and the fines being paid by their shareholders, not by their executives or board members, all of whom carry insurance. As if all of this weren't bad enough, the banks reportedly will be able to use government money to write down the value of mortgages, which amounts to subsidizing them to pay their own meaningless fines. That's Simon Johnson, the co-author of 13 Bankers, talking. Johnson again. The Obama administration's settlement with the mortgage lenders is consistent with its track record on all its policies related to the financial sector, which has been abysmal. At stake in the mortgage settlement are fundamental and systemic breaches of the rule of law, perjury and fraud on an economy-wide scale. The Justice Department has, without question, all of the power that it needs to prosecute these alleged crimes fully. And yet America's top law enforcement officials have consistently and now completely backed off. Truth be told, the lunatics are pretty much running the government asylum. Government Sachs is still atop the heap, and it plays both sides of the gang world. Clinton's Treasury Secretary was former Goldman CEO Robert Rubin. Another ex-Goldman CEO, Hank Paulson, ran Treasury under Bush when, coincidentally, wink, Goldman received $23 billion during the TARP bailout. Not to mention the corporation getting a sizable chunk of the $180 billion that AIG, the insurance godzilla, was awarded from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York when it was presided over by Timothy Geithner, who is now Secretary of the Treasury. Here's Bill Black, the savings and loan regulator during the Reagan years and now a professor at the University of Missouri, speaking to Bill Moyers. The Bush administration and now the Obama administration kept secret from us what was being done with AIG. AIG was being used secretly to bail out favored banks like UBS and like Goldman Sachs. In the months leading up to the 2008 meltdown, he, Geithner, took absolutely no effective action. He gave no warning. He did nothing in response to the FBI warning that there was an epidemic of fraud. All this pig-in-the-poke stuff happened under him. Geithner helped Goldman Sachs instantly convert from an investment house to a commercial bank, making the company eligible for those ballooning government handouts. He then gave Goldman a $30 billion taxpayer-funded loan at 0.01% interest. Not a bad deal, especially at a time when ordinary folks who missed a few credit card payments in order to finance their mortgages were being slapped with interest rates of more than 25%. Well, after all, Goldman Sachs gave nearly $1 million to the Obama campaign in 2008. Entering the Obama administration from Goldman were Gary Gensler, to chair the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Robert Hormats, Under Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs, and Mark Patterson, an ex-Goldman lobbyist named Geithner's chief of staff. In the meantime, White House counsel Gregory Craig positioned himself to become one of Goldman's legal eagles. Lloyd Blankfein, current Goldman CEO, hired another new lawyer specifically to help with the Department of Justice's investigation into whether he might have done something illegal. The new lawyer, Reid Weingarten, used to work at Justice with Eric Holder. And now that Holder is the U.S. Attorney General, Weingarten is still among his closest friends. Lawrence Summers, Obama's other prime economic advisor, got paid $135,000 by Goldman back in 2008 for a one-day visit to the company. Altogether, his speaking fees in 2008, the year of the financial meltdown, were over $2.7 million from the likes of Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch. Summers also collected about $5.2 million in compensation from D.E. Shaw, a hedge fund bigwig, for some part-time work that year. And you think those companies weren't thinking ahead about which of them were going to benefit from how the government responded to the crisis? Summers, back in 1999, along with Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, was also the main man in blocking Congress from voting in legislation designed to regulate the derivatives market. Just think about how this works, Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald has written. People like Rubin, Summers, and Gensler shuffle back and forth from the public to the private sector and back again. When in government, they ensure that the laws and regulations are written to rebound directly to the benefit of a handful of Wall Street firms, literally abolishing all safeguards and allowing them to pillage and steal. Then, when out of government, they return to those very firms and collect millions upon millions of dollars, profits made possible by the laws and regulations they implemented when in government. Then, when their party returns to power, they return back to government, where they continue to use their influence to ensure that the oligarchical circle that rewards them so massively is protected and advanced. This corruption is so tawdry and transparent, and it has fueled and continues to fuel a fraud so enormous and destructive as to be unprecedented in both size and audacity, that it is mystifying that it is not provoking more mass public rage. Rahm Emanuel, named as Obama's chief of staff and now the mayor of Chicago, used to be a director at the mortgage giant Freddie Mac, a recipient of $150 billion in bailout bucks. In the summer of 2010, an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico exploded, jetting tons and tons of crude oil into the water. This oil well was owned by BP. At the time of the explosion, Rahm Emanuel was living rent-free in a Washington, D.C. apartment owned by Stanley Greenberg, one of the top advisors to BP, which gave rise to some speculation. Might Emanuel have compromised government efforts to regulate the oil industry? Perish the thought. Elizabeth Warren, who set up the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and is now running for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, said of Obama, "He's got to know that his angry words at Wall Street, at their recklessness and dangerous incentives and compensation, about how they do their business in ways utterly divorced from what's actually good for the economy, that he can't just say that sort of thing and then dump money in their laps and be credible." One of Obama's main pledges during the 08 campaign was that he'd get rid of the Bush administration's tax cuts for the rich that helped create the huge deficit. Instead, when they were set to expire in December 2010, he extended them for another 2 years. That was a folded hand that a lot of his former supporters found simply baffling. More recently, the Obama administration has proposed to lower corporate taxes from 35% down to 28% for most companies and 25% for manufacturers. This is called being revenue neutral because another proposal is closing loopholes like letting corporations send their earnings overseas in order to pay lower taxes. Supposedly, this makes up for the lost revenue. But do these guys really need lower taxes? Back in 1953, under Eisenhower, corporate taxes accounted for 32% of total federal tax revenues. Now they're only 10%. Then came the debt ceiling debacle, where the extortion by the Republicans seemed to bring the Democrats to their knees once again. How can American democracy work, asked columnist Paul Krugman, if whichever party is most prepared to be ruthless to threaten the nation's economic security gets to dictate policy? And the answer is, maybe it can't. And that's a level-headed Nobel Prize-winning economist talking. Here's one I really don't get. After the most fraud-riddled financial crisis in our history, and not a single bankster being prosecuted, at the same time the Obama Justice Department has decided to reverse a campaign promise to leave the medical marijuana dispensaries alone provided they abided by state law. They're shutting down these places like crazy, especially in California, where medical pot has been legal for approved patients for 15 years. And while the mega corporations managed to avoid taxes altogether, the IRS has told the pot clinics they can't deduct salaries or other operating expenses, meaning their tax bill generally ends up exceeding their profits. The Harborside Health Center in Oakland, biggest dispensary in the country, got sent a $2.4 million tax bill from the IRS in the fall of 2011. As a longtime advocate for legalization, which would stop the drug cartels in their tracks, I'd really like to know what's going on here. Medical marijuana is legal in 16 states and the District of Columbia. When he ran for president, Obama said he was not going to be using the Justice Department resources to try to circumvent state laws on this issue, like his predecessor had. Here's what the Justice Department said during Obama's first year. Prosecution of individuals with cancer or other serious illnesses who use marijuana is part of a recommended treatment regimen consistent with applicable state law or those caregivers in clear and unambiguous compliance with existing state law who provide such individuals with marijuana is unlikely to be an efficient use of limited federal resources. Now, that was all well and good, until there came another memo in early 2011 that redefined what a caregiver was and threatened action in states that had made medical marijuana legal. During the first 3 years of Obama, the feds made more than 100 raids on pot dispensaries, on track to break Bush's record. This is outrageous. In July 2010, the Department of Veterans Affairs gave its blessing to medical marijuana for returning soldiers. Then Michelle Leonhardt, who headed the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, under Bush, got renominated by Obama to head the agency. She'd once been told by then-House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers that she was going after medical pot dispensaries in a way typically reserved for the worst drug traffickers and kingpins. But this was the same woman who'd called the murders of almost 1,000 Mexican kids by the cartels a sign of success in the fight against drugs. So her DEA followed up with a report that included headings like "Smoked marijuana is not medicine." That was when the crackdown really took off. Federal prosecutors in D.C. have gone so far as to threaten state employees with potential felony charges under the Controlled Substances Act if they didn't take a hard line on new regs for the dispensaries. In response, two governors, Washington State's Christine Gregoire and Rhode Island's Lincoln Chafee, petitioned the DEA to reclassify marijuana as a drug with recognized medicinal value. "It's time to show compassion, and it's time to show common sense," said Gregoire. "We call on the federal government to end the confusion and the unsafe burden on patients." For its part, the White House keeps saying its position is clear and consistent. Just like the financial institutions. According to an article in Rolling Stone, the federal war on medical marijuana has locked pot dispensaries out of the banking system, especially in Colorado, home to the nation's second-largest market for medicinal cannabis. Top banks, including Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, are refusing to do business with state-licensed dispensaries for fear of federal prosecution for money laundering and other federal drug crimes. Don't you just love how law-abiding the big banks have become lately? Just one problem. If pot dispensaries are forced to work outside the usual system, as Representative Jared Polis warned Attorney General Holder, it makes the industry harder for the state to track, to tax, to regulate them, and in fact makes it prone to robberies because it becomes a cash business. Look, the number of people put in prison for nonviolent drug offenses has risen more than 12 times since 1980. At the same time, global consumption of opiates has gone up 34.5%, cocaine 27%, and cannabis 8.5% from 1998 to 2008. And this is a successful war on drugs? After 40 years, our government has spent $1 trillion on this, and for what? How much of that has been spent to arrest over 37 million nonviolent drug offenders, including some 10 million for marijuana possession? $121 billion plus another $450 billion to lock the convicted up in federal prisons. This is what's criminal and a fiasco. So much so that a global commission on drug policy recommends to substitute treatment for imprisonment for people who use drugs but do no harm to others. But try telling that to whichever gang is in control of the White House. Obama's administration has put in place some good new rules, like raising fuel efficiency standards for new cars and trucks, so you'd think he might say something about the anti-regulatory sentiment that's so rampant in Congress. Instead, the president sounded more like the Chamber of Commerce in promising to root out regulations that conflict, that are not worth the cost, or that are just plain dumb. Obama's White House is watered down or quashed, a series of public health, consumer, and other regulatory protections ready for implementation. In August 2011, Bill Daley, the new White House chief of staff, held same-day meetings with various stakeholders to talk about a proposed EPA rule to tighten air pollution standards. Industry groups, according to the Wall Street Journal, handed the White House a map showing counties that would be out of compliance with the Clean Air Act if the stricter standards were put in place. The map showed that the rule would affect areas in the politically important 2012 election states of Florida, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Ohio. The Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, American Petroleum Institute, and others told Daily that going ahead with tougher restrictions would hurt Obama's re-election chances. So Obama caved on the tougher ozone regulations, sticking with the exposure level that Bush had set. In October, five environmental and health groups, including the American Lung Association, sued the administration for what it called an illegal action driven by politics. Not long after that, Obama's administration approved a plan by none other than BP to drill four new exploratory wells off the Louisiana coast. Drill, baby, drill was back. Then there's Monsanto, the chemical and biotech behemoth. Back in January 2011, a White House policy analyst got an email from a lobbyist with the Biotechnology Industry Organization, BIO, that represents genetically engineered GE seed companies like Monsanto and Syngenta. This apparently was related to a successful lawsuit by the Pier nonprofit to stop the planting of GE crops in northeastern wildlife refuges. The United States wants to step up exports of these, and it looks like there was collusion here. But the White House won't release a portion of the email, supposedly because it accidentally contained information on BIO's lobbying strategy that, if released, would cause competitive harm to the group and the companies it represents. As a patriotic American, I wish I could give this president the benefit of the doubt. I'd like to think that the speech he gave out in Osawatomie, Kansas, was the start of something different, where he talked about the breathtaking greed behind our economic disaster and how what's at stake is whether this will be a country where working people can earn enough to raise a family, build a modest savings, own a home, and secure their retirement. Maybe the Occupy Wall Street message was breaking through, but I'm afraid I'm like more and more of my countrymen. I see what our two-gang system has degenerated into as a quagmire that it's well-nigh impossible to extricate from without an occupation of our electoral politics.